Today's topic is Heart Sutra and its implication in our daily life. Can you hear me at the back? Can you hear me? Right. Heart Sutra is a very popular sutra that a lot of people heard of. But what is the content of the sutra? What does it try to teach us? A lot of people like to chant the Heart Sutra. There are also music that goes with it in a DVD or CD. People tend to chant the sutra all the time. But what really is the meaning of the sutra? So today we're going to talk a bit more on the sutra, and then after we have explained the sutra, then we'll talk about its implication in our daily life. Now the Heart Sutra, well, it's a common name. The official name of Heart Sutra, anyone knows the official name of the Heart Sutra?
Pajaparamita.
Is that all? Some of you have sang the Yeah. Alright, so we're going to explain the title first, because the title itself will then explain what the content of the sutra. Alright, so so it is called Pajna Paramita Pajaya Sutra. Now, so the literal translation of this topic into English will be, now this means the heart. The heart of the paramita sometimes is translated as perfection. Okay? So the heart of the perfection of wisdom. Yeah, Prajna means wisdom. Alright? So we're going to explain a bit more on this. So it's the heart of the discourses, or the heart of the refuge of the perfection of wisdom. So in other words, it's the essence of the perfection of the practice of wisdom. Okay? So now before we go on to talk about of the words and the meaning of the talk, the heading, the title, first just let me tell you a little bit of the background of the Heart Sutra. So Heart Sutra is just a common name, so the official name is this. Now this sutra was said to be compiled in Sanskrit in the 1st century AD, so it's the first in the Common Era. It was then translated into Chinese by Kumar Rajiva, who was a very famous translator in the 4th century AD. And then it was then translated by Master Xuanzang again in the 5th century. And then he named it as Heart Sutra. So initially it was not properly named as Heart Sutra, but then Xuanzang Master named it as Heart Sutra. So the Heart Sutra, especially the Chinese version that we are using now, is basically the version translated by Master Xuanzang. Now this sutra is a bit different from other sutra, where in other sutra usually you have an introduction paragraph and then the call and then the conclusion. But this sutra doesn't have an introduction and doesn't have a conclusion. It's just the core of it. So, and if you look at this Heart Sutra as compared to the Prajna Paramita Sutra, and that's why I just asked you, because they are what we call the last or the great. Right, so this is the main collection of the Prajna Paramita Sutra that then composed a lot of volumes. And this Heart Sutra, the content of the Heart Sutra, if you look at the main collection, the great collection of the Prajna Paramita Sutra, the content of Heart Sutra is very similar to one of the chapters in this large sutra that we have. So So the, and in fact, you find that the wordings, or the wordings, in fact, can be matched words by words in one of the chapter in the main sutra. So, especially in the Chinese version, in the Sanskrit version, the meaning is there, but then the words are not identical. So, there's no conclusion, there's no introduction. It seems like it is an extract from this last sutra, because Prajnaparamita is a very important teaching in Buddhism, and so for the ease of recitation and recollection, so the great master compile extract the core, the essence of the teachings, and put them into a hard sutra. But then you can actually trace back the origin into the last Prajnaparamita Sutra. Okay, so it is not someone who made it up, but yeah, you can still trace the origin. And this sutra, well, as some of you may have heard of the Heart Sutra, it starts with the Buddha, Buddhist, the Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, that who was contemplating on the five aggregates. So, but this sutra was actually spoken by the Buddha and telling Shariputra how this Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva has practiced. Okay, so we will explain a bit more on all these terms later, because it sounds very it's Sanskrit word. So that's just a bit of background of the origin and the translation of the sutra. Now, so let's talk about the name of the sutra. Now, paramita. Let's talk about paramita first. Paramita means completeness or perfection. It can also mean that which has gone beyond, that we are able to transcend beyond. So transcend from this side of the river to that side, that's the shore of bliss. So it also means transcend, or it means gone beyond, right? So paramita, the word para itself means beyond, alright, and mita means that which has arrived, so it means it has arrived at the shore beyond. Okay, so it means that you have crossed and has arrived at the shore beyond. So that is the meaning of paramita. So why do we want to cross from one side of one shore to the other shore? So in Buddhism, the aim of Buddhism is to solve suffering of life. We are in at the side of suffering, and we want to be able to cross this ocean of suffering and arrive at the other shore, that's the shore of bliss and happiness. So the aim of Buddhism is to stop suffering in life and attain a state of transcending suffering. And so the method that can help us to relieve from suffering so that we can arrive at the other shore is called paramita. That doesn't make sense? Alright? So when we practice according to the teachings and end suffering, it is also called paramita. So paramita basically can be used to describe an action of transcending to the other shore. Or the arrival at the other shore is also called paramita. So that is the meaning of paramita, which means it's a practice that can help us to transform ourselves and transcend suffering. So now if we confine this the definition of paramita to the scope of eliminating suffering, that the practices that can help us to free from suffering and transcend to be able to transcend ourselves from suffering to the state of the end of suffering. So we need to understand what is suffering, where does suffering come from, how to transcend all this suffering. So what is the method? Alright? So a paramita means, as we say, the paramita means the method that can help us relief from suffering. So when we talk about relief from suffering, first we need to know what suffering do we have. So I think you have heard about this quite a lot, the Four Noble Truths and so on. So suffering, we have physical suffering, we have mental suffering. So physical suffering can sometimes be reduced by advancements of science and medicine. They can relieve some of our physical suffering, but mental suffering, you find that sometimes medicine may not be able to help. They may be able to help you sleep, but even after you take too many sleeping pills, you find that it doesn't work anymore. And then when you're overdose, you have side effects. So sometimes if the doctor try to diagnose you and find that physically there's nothing wrong with you, but it's because of your mental stress or depression that has caused disturbance to your nervous system, they can't do much about it except to give you some medication to relax yourself, or you need to actually help yourself by listening to the teaching, learn to relax. So in order to overcome our mental suffering, it is the Dharma that can help us. So it is the Dharma that can help us to relieve from mental suffering. So we have physical suffering, mental suffering, and sometimes we say that we classify them into a few types of suffering. So we have birth, old age, sickness and death. These are suffering that arises due to changes in our physical body, and there are also suffering that arise due to social relationship. For example, to be separated from the beloved one, that is great suffering, or to be together with people that you do not like and you have to confront them every day, that is a lot of suffering as well, and also there are sufferings when your desire are not fulfilled. So these are all suffering. Now, where does this suffering come from? It comes from, what? Our attachment. We attach to things. Why do we attach? We crave. Why do we crave? Because it's part of our property. Is it? Humanity to crave. So we are born to crave. Is that right? Or we are born to crave? Is there any way to change it? Okay, so we can practice and change it. Alright, so we have a lot of craving. The craving comes from, as you say, from ourselves. Because when we see something that we like, we just crave for it, we just attach to it, and we don't even know why we crave for it. We just feel like, I want this to belong to me. That kind of sense of satisfaction, that I got more belongings than you. But what is it? What do you gain out of that when I have more than you?
You look higher.
It looks like you are better.
Okay.
So when I feel that I want to be to have more than you, and so when I have more than you, I will still feel that I need to have more. Is that what you mean, right? So we do not understand why do we want so many things. What you may say is, we need food to survive. Yes, that's good enough. But then think about it ourselves. Do we really just, are we contented with just having a house to stay, a car to drive, a job to work, and some food to eat? Are we contented with that? We tend to look for more and more and more, and we don't even know why we are chasing after so many things to satisfy this, what we want. So we do not know where does this desire come from, and we do not understand the things that we're attaching to as well. So in fact, we do not understand ourselves very well. We tend to just react very fast. When we see something nice, yes, I want it, and you say David Jones is on special offer, and then you find that everyone just rush and line up. That's what Boxing Day was, it right? People line up right in the early in the morning at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock. Do you think is it necessary? Not sure why, but still there are people lining up, taking their own chairs and sit down there waiting at 3 o'clock in the morning. You're sleeping back. So what are we actually chasing after? Are we chasing after ignorance? Huh? Oh, okay. So it's because of our ignorance. So we do not understand. We don't actually understand why do we have this urge. And so we just follow the urge and just go and go. We do not understand ourselves. And so, and that at the end leads us to a lot of stress, take away a lot of our time and energy. Every day we come back home very tired. Who have created all this for us? So, the problem of our suffering, where does this suffering come from? Because we do not understand ourselves, do not understand the things that we are attaching to. We don't understand what's going on in our mind. So we can't even control ourselves, not to say control other things. But we tend to be very demanding that we want to control other things. We like to control others, but we can't even control ourselves. So that is basically what is happening with us. So because of ignorance about ourselves, about things going around us, ignorance about our own behavior, we got ourselves into a lot of trouble. So how to end suffering? So live in the present. Yep. So if we can live in the present and not to dream too much about what you want or stay in the past, you probably feel more enjoyable. And that needs to come with an understanding that whatever we have now will change, and so whatever is in front of us, we appreciate them and enjoy what we have at the moment. Then you feel that you didn't carry with you so many burdens from the past, and also burden that for the future, right? So, but this needs to come with understanding. So how to end suffering? Of course, there's one way is that there are people, a passive way is that some people strengthen their ability to their resistance towards unfavorable circumstances. So they have better tolerance when wishes are not being fulfilled. They have better tolerance when things are not good. So, and then after they tolerate, if you can let go, that will be much better. But some people may just have better resistance towards when environment are not conducive, when wish are not being fulfilled. So they make him stand a bit longer, but still doesn't end suffering. And so in order to end the fundamental cause of suffering, we need to identify that it actually comes from our ignorance, our craving. So what is the method that we need to apply? How can we overcome craving and ignorance? If we can eliminate craving and ignorance, then problem will be solved. Alright? So that is first thing we talk about, paramita, that is really wants to end suffering. So now what is the method? The next word is prashna. Alright? So to eliminate this wrong desire that we have, wrong views that we have, the practice of six paramita is very important. So there are what we call the six paramita. That's what we talk about. Paramita are methods of practice that can help us to that can help us to transcend from the shore of suffering to the shore of bliss. So there are six paramita. Can you talk about six paramita? The six perfections. So six ways of practice that can help us to improve ourselves so that we can slowly develop ourselves, improve ourselves in our wisdom, as well as all our practices, so that we can be free from suffering and attend the shell of bliss. So six perfection means number one, that is practice of giving, generosity. So by practicing generosity, we learn to share with others rather than hanging on everything to ourselves. We have to understand that everything that we have, although we work very hard for what we have, but they actually come from the support of a lot of people. Although we may work very hard and earn a lot of money today, so therefore you can line up 3 a.m. In front of David Jones, but that now that you have the ability to earn so much money, where does this ability come from? You say, I have studied so hard at the university, so therefore I have this ability. But think about it, if there's no one who take care of you when you were a baby, no one who teach you when you were in childcare, preschool, kindergarten, primary school, high school, how can you have the ability today? And while you're going through this process, while you're going through your childhood, primary school, teenager time, and university, your living, whatever support that you have, it comes from a lot of people. So although it looks like our ability to work, to earn money, belongs to us, but in fact, it comes from the support of a lot of people. So now that we have this ability to work and all these skills that we have, we should not think that this is our sole property. We should learn to share with others. It is because other people support that we are here today. And so whatever skills that we have, in fact, we should not think of it as our sole property alone, but rather if we can, we learn to share with others. And so by having an attitude as such, we will have a sense of gratitude to the others, and then at the same time we learn to have to be less egoistic, that feeling that ourselves is so great. So if we can learn to share, learn to appreciate others, we find that you will be a happier person. So that is first, practicing giving. Second is precepts, upholding precepts. So upholding precepts, the Buddha set the guidelines for us. Precepts are like a mirror for us to see, is my desire going beyond? So we do have, we do have some desire. We can have some desire, some enjoyment within our right, but we have to make sure that we do not allow our desire to grow beyond, that infringe into other people's right or bring harm to the others. So the principle behind the precepts in Buddhism is to make sure that, is to remind us that we need to put ourselves in others' position, that whatever we do not like to happen to us, do not do it onto the others. So in that way, we can also reduce our greed, hatred, and jealousy, arrogance, do not allow them to grow too much. So that's precepts. And number three is tolerance. So we need to have patience to ourselves, patience to the others, and patience to the environment as well. We need to have patience, because in order to practice, if you are very impatient when you try to sit down meditating, today is too hot, I can't practice, tomorrow is too cold, I don't want to practice, When are you going to practice? We have to understand that we already have a lot of frustration and we are going around the cycle of life and death. And thinking about the suffering of not understanding the truth, getting caught in frustration all the time, that kind of suffering is worse than crossing your leg and having a bit of numbness of your leg. So sometimes if you feel, practice is torturing. Sit down there and meditating is boring. It's very uncomfortable. Now if you can't endure this bit of uncomfort, then there's no chance for us to actually improve ourselves. So we need to be patient, because our mind sometimes have a lot of thoughts and we have a lot of desire. We want to eat this, we want to eat that, and sitting down meditating. We start today, we have a meditation workshop. You sit down there, you say, I want to eat ice cream. But then you're sitting in the classroom, everyone's sitting there, the door is locked, and you can't go out. And you thought, why am I putting myself here, torturing myself? But if you are you get carried away by a desire and do not want to have any reflect, you do not want to reflect, why do I have this urge? Do I really need to eat ice cream at this time? Then there's no way for us to see the greed that's arising in ourselves and putting a bit of control and subdue it and dissolve it. So because we want to have a better control of ourselves, we all like to be the master of ourselves. We want to be the boss of ourselves. But the boss of ourselves, the master of ourselves, that what we want to be is a boss of ourselves, that we understand the truth and that we are actually at peace and ease. I'm not saying that I'm the boss of myself, don't criticize me, don't control me, that is different, right? We want to be the master of ourselves, where we can tell ourselves that be positive, do not be angry, do not be greedy, be diligent, then we will be diligent. If you can give yourself an instruction and you just follow, you can just do it, then you're the master of yourself. But we are not. We tell ourselves, there's a lot of assignments, exams is coming, I need to be hardworking. I need to wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning tomorrow. Can you do that? Tomorrow you turn on the alarm clock ring, you just press it down. Yes? Yes. Now,
is it possible to have, you've got a call and you're trying to have one for the effort, that's why?
Yes. So, well, the thing is that I'm not saying that to ask you to wake up at 5 o'clock and then never sleep. So I'm just trying to say that we want to tell ourselves to say, for example, we want our life to be a bit more disciplined than a bit too lax. So if we tell ourselves that I have been too lazy, I have been waking up at 12 o'clock noontime every day, I want to wake up at 10 o'clock. We want to discipline ourselves. So can we listen to ourselves, listen to our own instructions? Well, not to say about all this, just talking about breathing just then. Focus your mind on your breathing. Don't listen to the noise outside. Our ears seem to just go away. Our mind just go away. Our mind belongs to us. Does the mind belong to us? But it goes away. You are telling your mind, say, observe the breathing. But then someone is talking outside. We don't even know who is talking there. But our mind seems to be more interested in what people are talking about. And it goes away. Some guys was making noise down there. Nothing to do with us. But we tend to get disturbed. So we are not listening to our own mind. So we need to have patience, be able to tolerate the discomfort of the environment, to be patient to the others, to be patient to ourselves as well. Because this is something very important in our practice. If we cannot be patient and tolerate because when you say tolerate, it is because what we want to do is not in accordance to our habits, and that's why you feel that you need to tolerate. To some other people, they may not need to tolerate. They don't think that that issue needs to tolerate. It's just very easy to them. Can you see? Can you? So when we practice patience or tolerance, that's where you need to see. Why do I feel that it's so difficult? But for my friend, this is easy. So in other words, because what this rule that has been set is probably not in accordance to our habits, and that's why we need to adjust. It's just like the branch of the tree that has grown that way, and you need to pull it back, and that's why you find it keep on falling back, and so you get very frustrated. Why is it falling that side all the time? It's just like if you are driving, and if you are a driver who likes to speed, all right, and you're looking at school zone 40. You just feel like it's so impatient. But if you are a person who always follow the rules, and you are not a person who likes to drive too fast, then you find it 40, 60, okay. You don't feel like you need to fight with yourself. Some people, wherever they go, they just want to speak to 80. And so when they say 60, they just feel 60, and then the car in front just drives at 60, exactly 60, and then you're following behind so slow, you just feel that it's so slow, and you start to feel a bit impatient. Is that right? So, tolerance. We have to, when we practice tolerance, you see, the Buddha said all these practices, it allows us to use these practices to respect ourselves. See, desire in ourselves. Why do I need to speak so fast? See? So these are opportunities for us to practice. So practicing Buddhism is in our daily life. It is when we communicate with one another, when we are living in this world, you find that every moment, if we bear in mind the teachings, every moment we can reflect ourselves according to the teachings, every moment is the time to practice. Right, and then number four is religion. Right, in order to practice all these, as we say, sometimes it's not our habit. We need to put effort into cultivating it. So diligence is important. We need to have this urge, to have this right effort in practice, in practicing giving, upholding precepts, tolerance. And then this is meditation. And this is prajna or wisdom. So if we can bear in mind all these teachings and have right effort, diligence in practice, then the next thing is meditation. We need to practice meditation. Practicing meditation can help us to have better resistance towards external distractions, because if you practice regularly, observing your breathing, thoughts come, let it go, bring on my back, noise come, let it go, bring on my back, you know what is your primary focus. So you find that when you need to focus, your ability to bring your mind back will be much faster. So for example, if you always practice meditation, and your mind will be at a certain level of calmness all the time, most of the time, right? So when you want to study, for exams or assignments, there could be some noise going around, but if you tell yourself, no, I want to ignore all those, I want to concentrate on this, you find that your ability to just ignore will be better. Your ability to focus will be better as well. So that's why as students, practicing meditation is actually very important. A lot of students thought, I'm too busy, I don't have time to practice meditation. In fact, if you spare a bit of time practicing meditation every day, you find that your study can be more efficient. Because a lot of time we have wasted our time in daydreaming. We wasted our time in going around and not settling ourselves before we study. If your mind is focused and not distracted, you find that after you have done certain you have gone to uni and you have done certain tasks, come back home, taking a shower after a rest, immediately you can study. But there are people, after coming home from uni and then talking to their friends for a while, their mind is still wandering on the conversation, and then they start to go around trying to see what to do, and then flip around the books and do not know what to do. Their mind are not settled. So although you may, it looks like you spend a lot of time in trying to touch on the book, but you are not sitting down and settling yourself to absorb it as yet. But people who practice meditation, they are more they are able to become more structured and organized in themselves. Whenever they need to sit down and settle themselves, they just focus their mind quickly. So we all have 24 hours. How can we make full use of the 24 hours efficiently? So meditation can help a lot, right? So because when we meditate, you know that, okay, this is what I want to do. Are the other things, put them aside first, concentrate on this for 2 hours, and then you do the other things for another hour, do another thing first. So you find it all organized. And when you do this particular task, you focus your mind. You become more efficient. So practicing meditation, and then finally it's the development of wisdom. Now, so these are the six paramita, six practices that can help us to develop ourselves. And finally help guide us towards the shore of bliss. Now, so of course there are six perfections here, but the most important is the wisdom. These five paramitas or five perfections need to be guided by wisdom. Because if it is not guided by wisdom, we may still fall into attachment. Say for example, you practice giving. And then after you practice giving, a lot of people praise you, you're such a good person. And then you start to feel, yes, I'm so good. And then you start to have your arrogance grow, and then next time when you practice, no one say anything, you get very upset. I'm not going to do it anymore. So this practice will not help you. So the practice needs to be guided by wisdom. That is the wisdom of understanding that this self that we tend to cling on to is actually a combination of many causes and conditions. Our skills, ability come from the support of all of people. They are a combination of causes and conditions as well. We should not be so self-centered. We should learn to appreciate others, learn to be less to be selfless. Then in that way, when we practice giving, we in fact appreciate that. Through this practice of giving, we realize that the skill that I have, now that I have ability to help, so amazing that I can help. But where does the skill come from? Where is the truth of this skill? This skill comes from the combination of so many causes and conditions since my young age until now. Where is the truth of the skill? You find that it is causes and conditions. And that I'm able to do this because there's a recipient there who needs the help. If there's no recipient there, my skill is of no use. So this act of giving that I'm practicing is because of the right causes and conditions that arises at the same time. Because I happen to have this skill, and that there's a recipient who happens to need that this kind of skill, and we met at the right time and right space, at right place, and so therefore the act of giving can be carried out. So everything arises due to causes and conditions. What is that something that I had to be so arrogant about? So it is through this we start to understand more about the truth and understand the teaching of causes and conditions, and I understand that we are actually just part of the causes and conditions. So in that way our arrogance will not grow, and then we start to reflect more according to the teaching, and that's how we can further develop our wisdom. So the practice has to be guided by wisdom, and then it will help us to improve our wisdom furthermore. So So same thing with our upholding of precepts, tolerance, diligence, and so on. So prajna is very important. Prajna is the wisdom. So it guides the five parameters. But then it doesn't mean that prajna is the most important, so therefore we only need to practice prajna. Now prajna itself, without the others, it is just a wisdom, no application. It's just like you have the skill, there's no place to use it, but no use then. So we say that the prajna guides the five paramitas. The five paramitas at the same time adorn the prajna, allows the wisdom to be presented more fully. So that's prajna. So now, what is the difference between let's talk a bit about the prajna. What does prajna mean? What's the difference between prajna and the worldly knowledge? So sometimes we translate prajna as wisdom. But this wisdom is different to the worldly knowledge. Prajna is the profound realization of the truth. It's the realization of the truth itself. So the truth, the truth that we are talking about here, basically is the truth of, so the Buddha, when he attained enlightenment, he realized this truth. Now this truth of in Buddhism, is the truth of cause and effect, but then it's not just simply just cause and effect. It is between this series of phenomena of cause and effect that you can also see that the truth of impermanence, the truth of causes and conditions, selflessness, and the truth of nirvana. Now, when that we say that everything in the universe falls into the law of cause and effect. Now, how can a cause and effect happen? If an action is done, it has fixed identity, then it just stays as it is all the time. How can a cause finally change up to end up to be an effect? You plant an apple seed, why does it become an apple tree? If the seed is a fixed identity, then it should stay as a seed forever. But a seed will sprout and then grow and then become an apple tree, and you have more apples on the apple tree. So it basically tells us that during this process there is impermanence that's going on, because the seed is impermanent. It can change. So therefore it with some other causes and conditions, water, fertilizer and so on, it starts to sprout. And it sprouts, and every moment it is changing. And it is changing because of the supply of many causes and conditions as well. So the seed itself is a combination of many causes and conditions, so therefore it can take in new causes and conditions and keep on developing and changing. If the seed itself is a fixed identity, a fixed solid things without any process and conditions, then there's no way to take in any more new things. So the seed itself arrives is a combination of causes and conditions, and it can take in more causes, other causes and conditions as well. And so that's why it keep on developing. It's just like our body and mind as well. If we are fixed, then we are born as a baby, we should still always stay like this, as small as this, as a baby. But why are you all here? Because we are causes and conditions. And so during the process of, so during this series of cause and effect, you find that there's the truth of impermanence that's taking part, the truth of selflessness that's taking part, and that everything is in the process of changing causes and conditions. It is just as such. So that is something that the Buddha has realized. So it is just like the wave in the ocean. When it's very wavery, you see the wave very rough. When there's no wind, there's no the causes and conditions for the wave to arise because of the wind. Now when there's no wind, you find that the ocean is peaceful. But the water itself, the peacefulness of the water, the essence of the water is still the same. Whether it's a wave, the water in a wave, or the water that is peaceful, the water is still the water. That is what we meant by that everything that we see, that they may transform from one appearance to another. They are combination of causes and conditions, but the essence of it is always the same. It's always as such. That is what we mean by the state of nirvana. The state of nirvana, which is just as such. But it's just because of the causes and conditions that we see the wind of afflictions, we create all kinds of appearance, all kinds of phenomena. But it itself, the essence of it, is just always the same. So that is the state of nirvana. So this is the truth that the Buddha realized. And in the Mahayana teaching, we tend to use the word emptiness to describe a state as such. A state where everything is, that everything, that the existence arises due to causes and conditions, it is always in the process of changing, and there's no fixed identity that you can cling on to. So we call it, because it's a state as such and very difficult to describe, so we use the word emptiness. So emptiness, when you come across the word emptiness in Buddhism, please do not fall into the trap and think that everything becomes hollow, everything disappears. Now, emptiness in Buddhism basically means that everything arises due to causes and conditions, it is all always in the process of changing, there's no fixed identity. It's just like when you see the cloud in the sky. Sometimes you see this cloud looks like a Santa Claus. And then suddenly it looks like an aeroplane. But we know that they are just water vapor, right? Because of the reflection that from the angle that we look at, the density of the water vapor there, so it forms certain images according to what we think. But we know that it is not real. When the wind blows, it keeps on changing, it keeps on changing. In fact, every phenomena in the world is just as such. It's just that when the causes and conditions come together at a temporary stable state, it looks like a certain appearance. But because our wisdom is not thorough, we tend to cling on to the appearance and then thought that, okay, this is it. And then we name it something. And then we cling on to it. That is the problem that we have. So for someone who realizes the truth, understand that everything are just causes and conditions, they are all in the process of changing, there's no fixed identity. And this is what we mean by emptiness in Buddhism. So this is the truth that is always as such. And in fact, it has to be as such, because if it's not as such, this world will be very rigid. We can't have so many things. How can we have so many invention and so many things going around? Because everything can be reshuffled and then you can create new things. So it's always as such, and it has to be as such, and it is as such at any time, at any place. This is just whether you are in Australia or US or England, it's always as such. So this is the truth that we need to realize. Whereas worldly understanding, worldly knowledge will be just a common understanding that we have. They may be just partially correct or not correct. Some of the things that we ourselves know that it is still not very correct. Say for example, there are the doctor may diagnose and say, oh, this person has cancer, we use this medicine and it can be cured. And we thought, yes, this knowledge could be right at this time, but then the doctor themselves know that they haven't even found the real cause of the problem. So they are just trying out all this medication hope that it can solve the problem. But it is not solving the problem in the ultimate way. Right? So the outworldly knowledge which can help us sometimes, but as you're all studying at the university, you know that there are always rooms for improvement. So in other words, it's not ultimate as yet. And that's why you want to write another thesis on top of other people's thesis, try to find their loopholes, try to find their mistakes, or try to find the part that they haven't investigated. So in other words, it is not ultimate. Right? So that is worldly knowledge, and worldly knowledge always encompasses our self-perception, which comes from our what we think from ourselves, from what we ourselves perceive, and our consciousness on what we feel about things. It is not necessarily the truth itself. So that is worldly knowledge. So in order to eliminate all this wrong understanding, so the reason why we say the cause of suffering that we say just then come from our ignorance and our craving. So as we say ignorance, because it is because we do not understand ourselves, do not understand the things around us. So in order, and then because of that we develop strong craving, desire for things. So in order to eliminate this wrong understanding and make sure that we do not carry out wrong actions, we need to rely on the realization of the wisdom of Prajna. So we have to understand that the problem that we have in our mind are attachment to ourselves, attachment to phenomena. These are the causes, the fundamental causes of our suffering. So to eliminate this, we need to realize emptiness of self. Alright? So that's why this sutra's name called Prajna Paramita. Prajna is basically the method that we need to apply so that we can transcend ourselves from the shore of suffering to the shore of happiness. And so this is the part of this teaching. So it's the heart of the Prajna Paramita, the teachings of the Prajna Paramita. So the heart here can mean the heart of is the core, or among the sutras of Prajna, this is the core. As we say, it is a collection, it is an extract from a chapter in the large Prajna Paramita Sutra. So we can say that it is the among the sutras of Prajna, this is the core, this is the essence. We can also say that the practice of the perfection of wisdom or Prajna Paramita is the heart among all Mahayana practices. So in other words, Mahayana practice emphasizes the core, the practice of Prajna Paramita. Okay, so that's the introduction of the heading. But it's all right, because that is the important part, and then the next part is to talk about the contents of the sutra. So the content of sutra, how many of you have heard of the sutra before? You all have sang the sutra? Who wants to sing the sutra? Alright, the first paragraph in fact is the essence of the whole sutra. If we explain the first paragraph powerfully, the others will just follow. Okay? So the first paragraph states that when Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara was practicing the profound Prajna Paramita, he illuminated the five aggregates and saw that they are all empty, and he crossed beyond all suffering and difficulty. So this paragraph first is when Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. Now you all have heard of Avalokiteshvara. Bodhisattva is someone who has realization, who has attained realization. Sattva means being, right? Being who has attained Bodhi. Okay. Ava means down. look is means to observe. Okay. Lokita means observe. So, and Isvara means someone who is free and at ease, but not constrained. So, Avalokiteshvara means someone who looks upon the world and who is at peace and at ease, who basically contemplates. So, in other words, we can say that if someone who have contemplated and realized the truth, and who is at peace and at ease. Okay, so this Avalokiteshvara in this sutra may not necessarily refer to the Guan Yin that we always that sometimes people think about. So it basically means that a bodhisattva, a person who has practiced and realized the truth and attained peace and ease, we can call them Avalokiteshvara. Okay, so it says that when Avalokiteshvara bodhisattva was practicing the profound prajna paramita, now this Avalokiteshvara bodhisattva has already attained peace and ease realization, but when he was practicing, trying to penetrate the truth of the profound prajna paramita, he realized the five aggregates. He was contemplating on the five aggregates and realized that they are all empty in nature. So what are the five aggregates? Is it? Oh, okay. So five aggregates. So we know. So we leave it to next week. But I'll just tell you a little bit, so you can ask the speaker next week. So what is form? Some of you should know this. Sensation. There's the fourth one. So it's so with mental formation, there is the fourth. It's perception. And then consciousness. Right, so this is what we mean by the five aggregates. There is five collections of the what we have in our physical our body and mind. So form refers to the physical body that we have. So once we have this physical body, we have our eyes, our ears, our nose, our tongue, and bodily contact, and so on. And when you have contact with external environment, we will have sensation, feeling, light and dislike, comfort or discomfort. And so we develop a perception. Right, is it round? Is it soft? Is it smooth? So perception. And so this perception, a lot comes from the education that we have gone through. So perception, and then once we have this perception, then we have mental formation. Mental formation is all kinds of mental activity that we start to think that, hey, I like it, I'm going to take this, I'm going to buy this, or things like this. So you start to have this making decision in your mind what you want to do with it, right? And then consciousness. So we start to have this awareness. We start to discriminate the things that we see. So this is what happens. So this is the physical part, and these are the mental part of our daily activity. So this is the physical part, and this is the mental part. Okay. So, in fact, if you look at ourselves, our daily activity is no other than our body with contact with external environment. We have this perception, mental formation, and then consciousness, and then we start to transform into action, speech, and thought. So this is what make up our everyday activities, and this forms this human beings that we have. That this is what we call as an eye. But if you look at this eye that we thought that it's a solid eye, that we are so great, but it's no other than a combination of activities of these five aggregates. These five aggregates are actively working together that we are a lively, energetic human being. So when the Bodhisattva, when the Avalokiteshvara was practicing, contemplating on these five aggregates, he realized that in fact every of these are empty in nature. Form, the physical body that we have. We love our body so much. We clean ourselves, our body every day, put perfume on, we comb our hair. But your hair drops. Our body smells. If our body is as good as it's supposed to be, no changes, why do you need to take shower every day? Why does your hair drop? Means some changes going on. So this body that we have, if you think about it carefully, it's changing every moment. There's no 1 second that is identical. Sometimes you feel hungry. Are you hungry now? You have eaten your breakfast. Why are you hungry now? So, our blood is circulating every moment. Our metabolism is rising and falling. Your cell is rising and falling. Your nervous system is and so if you look at this whole body, your organs and every part of them, they are changing every second. So there's no one fixed point that it is exactly the same. And if you look into every part of yourself, it's a combination of so many causes and conditions. In fact, our body, our human body, is more complicated than your computer. Sometimes you open up, you look at the computer, you look at the chips and things, it's very complicated, all the microchips and all these things that you have. But if you look into your human body, look at the nervous system that we have, it's so complicated. If you are an electrician, you know how to do the wiring. This wiring in our body is much, much more complicated. So, you first realize that this body that we cling on to, every moment is changing. It's a right, it's combination of so many causes and conditions. There's no fixed identity, and that's why we say it's empty nature. Same thing with sensation. Sensation, where does sensation come from? Contact with external environment. And so transform the information, and then we start have consciousness. Oh, yes, I like it, and things like this. So this sensation arises because of our bodily contact with external environment. This body that we have itself is already causes and conditions. And the things that we have contact with is also causes and conditions. So, what is the truth of this contact? It's transmission of information that comes through our feelings. And same thing with perception, mental formation, consciousness. They are all combination of causes and conditions, all in the process of changing. There's no 1 second that's identical. There's no one point that you can cling on and say that it is fixed. So there's no fixed identity. Keep on changing. The thoughts in our mind keep on changing as well. From just now until now, the thoughts that you have were different. So he realized that they are all empty. And he realized that this body and mind that we cling on to, it is just a combination of causes and conditions in the process of changing. There's nothing to cling on to. When he let go of this self-attachment, he then crossed beyond all suffering. So, in order to end suffering, we need to realize selflessness. Realize this, what we are attaching to, that we are clinging on to, is not there's actually nothing that we can cling on to. You want to cling on to this body, but if you want to change it, which one are you to cling on to? You can't hold on. You are holding on to your nose. Even your nose is changing everything. Right? So there's no point. But so where are you clinging on to? So he realized that, once he realized that, he crossed beyond all suffering and difficulties. So at the end, the Buddha said, Shariputra, form does not differ from emptiness, emptiness does not differ from form. I think that is something that you have heard, that so form and emptiness, we are not contradicting. Some people say, oh, form is something that we can see. How can you say this is empty? But the sutra says, the form does not differ from emptiness, emptiness does not differ to form. What does it mean? Is that confusing? Because form is emptiness. Well, because as we say, the form itself is an appearance that we see, but this appearance arises due to causes and conditions, and it is always in the process of changing. Although at the stable state it looks solid, but every moment it is still in the process of changing. It's just a metal rod. You put it there, you find that after 2 years, you find, oh, it's rust, it has rusted. It doesn't rust in a sudden. The oxidation process take place every moment. So because this form that we see is just an appearance, it's in its essence, it doesn't have a fixed identity. It doesn't have a fixed self nature. It is causes and conditions. It is in the process of changing. Its essence is empty. So when we talk about emptiness, so the form, if you realize the truth of the form, then there's no contradiction to emptiness. So emptiness does not differ from form as well. It's just like the cloud, that the example of the cloud that we see. You thought it's a Santa Claus, but you know that this is not real. It is empty in nature. You will keep on changing. Does that make sense? Alright. So for since itself is so we say that form itself is emptiness. Emptiness itself is form. There's no contradiction, because the form that we see is the true nature of the form is emptiness. So form itself is emptiness. Emptiness itself is form. So same thing applies to our sensation, perception, mental formation, and consciousness. So that is how the Avalokiteshvara contemplate and realize this truth. And then from there on, it start to elaborate a bit more. Basically, it's talking about the same thing, that everything does not have fixed self nature. So as long as you understand that there's no fixed self that you can cling on to, is no contradiction to emptiness. So say Shariputra, all phenomena or all dharmas are empty of characteristics. They are not produced, not destroyed, not defiled or not pure. They're neither increased or diminished, because everything are just causes and conditions in the process of changing. There's no fixed identity, there's no fixed self. So what, since there's no fixed self, then how can you say that something is being produced or something is being destroyed? It's only when you have something, say that this is something fixed, then you say this thing is being produced. Then when this thing disappears, you say this thing has been destroyed. But if there's no fixed self that you can cling on to, what is rising and what is falling? So, and same thing, then you can't say that, because everything just causes and conditions, so you can't say which one is pure, which one is defiled. It doesn't mean that when you take away the impurity, then purity arises, because they are just causes and conditions. It's not fixed in identity. And same thing, since there's no fixed identity, then what can you say about increased and decrease. This is only when you have a certain thing that you say, okay, this is the volume, and then it increase or it decrease. But if there's no fixed identity, fixed self nature, what is decreasing and what is increasing? So that's what it meant. And then, so therefore, in emptiness, there's no form, no feeling, no real form, feeling, sensation, perception, mental formation, consciousness. And then it goes on to talk about our eyes, ears, nose, body or mind, and our eyes contact with sight, sound, smell, taste, object at contact, and contact, they are all empty in nature as well. And then even the consciousness that they develop, the eye contact with the external object, and then develop eye consciousness, the ear hear a sound, and then develop ear consciousness. All this consciousness that arises due to causes and conditions as well. It doesn't have a fixed self nature. So they are also empty in nature. So that's how these Heart Sutra go on to give examples on starting from the five aggregates. Then it talks about the 12 spheres where that's the our eyes, our ears, our nose, our tongue, our bodily contact, and our mind contact with external environment. All these are empty nature. And then once we understand that, then next it go on to the 12 links or dependent origination. Can we talk about that? No. Because basically the Heart Sutra is as we say, it's an essence of the Prajnaparamita. It covers a lot of the teachings within the few words that it has. So basically it covers five aggregates, the six sense organs, six objects, six consciousness, and then also it covers the 12 links of dependent origination, the four noble truths. All these are all empty in nature. So when we talk about 12 links, we say, how do we go around the cycle of life and death again and again? Because of our ignorance. Our ignorance leads to our volitional action, we create karma, and then we start to have consciousness, and then lead on to our craving for continuous existence. Then we have consciousness, and then we need to a new rebirth. Then we have this form, body and mind, and then we have six sense organs, and then we have contact, and then we have once they have contact, then we have sensation. We have sensation. We have craving, and then it goes on and on. And go around the cycle again and again. But so some people tend to cling on to the 12 links, the 12 items, and okay, from this you move on to this, move on to this. But in fact, every part of this is just for the ease of explanation that ignorance leads to karma. So ignorance is not a fixed identity. Karma is not doesn't have fixed self identity as well, because ignorance arises with causes and conditions. Karma arises due to causes and conditions as well. And so the 12 links itself is an explanation, but then you can't hold on to each link and say this is from station A, move on to station B, and move on to station C. It is not as such. The station itself are causes and conditions. The station itself are selfless. So and that's why, because it is selfless, it is causes and conditions, it is subject to change, therefore we can reverse the cycle by practicing and realize the truth and end the cycle of life and death. If these stations are all fixed, first then you wouldn't move from station A to station B, because it's fixed, you can't move. So the Heart Sutra then goes on to say the 12 links and also the four noble truths are basically empty in nature as well. So you have to understand that empty in nature means that it is causes and conditions, it is in the process, it is always changing, and that And finally, even the wisdom that we taught, I have attained certain wisdom. There's no real wisdom that you can attain and say, oh, yes, this is the wisdom that you can hold on to. The wisdom that when you realize the prajna is basically the truth. The truth is just as such. It's not something that you can cling on to. Right? So basically nothing is attainable. But we tend to chase after a lot of things. I want to attain this, I want to attain that. And so we tend to think, I want to attain that. This is how habitually we think. But in fact, everything are causes and conditions. There's no fixed self nature. So the Bodhisattva, through realization of this prajna paramita, doesn't have any more worries in himself, because things are just as such. So a Bodhisattva who has realized this truth, we have no fear. Why do we have fear? Yes? So because we but that is the fear arises because we think that there's an I. We start to protect an I because we are afraid that when I go out of the cave, I may be eaten by the tiger. But if you realize selflessness, there's no I, then who is going to be eaten? So all fears that we have comes from because we of self-protection, self-defensiveness. When we start to defend ourselves, we start to have worry, we start to feel that other people may be threatening us, and that's how jealousy, arrogance, hatred arise. So someone who realizes the truth, they don't cling onto themselves anymore. They realize selflessness, and that's why they are at peace and at ease. They are free from fear. They have no worries, and also they let go all improper thoughts, because whatever we think at this moment are using our consciousness, which is backed up by our self-centeredness and self-perception. But someone who realizes the truth, they see the truth as it is, rather than coming from that I see how is it. So what we see is basically consciousness, that it is our organs, contact with external environment, and then we have this consciousness. And this process, within this process, there are a lot of causes and conditions that's taking place, that what we have been educated, what we have been taught, can also add on to what we see. Say if we see something and our mom told us before that is very horrifying, immediately we have the fear. You see, some of our background, whatever we have heard, can add on to our feeling. So this is what happened to us this now, because we still have this self-centeredness. We tend to protect ourselves subconsciously. So anything that we feel that is of threat to us, we start to feel, to have fear. So a Bodhisattva who has realized the truth of selflessness, they do not cling on to themselves anymore. They have no fear, and also whatever they think will be just according to the truth. So ultimately, of course, then they attain the ultimate nirvana, peace and ease, free from distorted thoughts, free from improper thoughts. So this is how all Buddhas from the past present and the future practice and attain the supreme enlightenment. So it is true, and the practice is true, the Prajna Paramita. So we therefore need to know that Prajna Paramita is a great mantra, a great bright mantra, a supreme mantra. Now, what is mantra? So what is mantra? Well, a lot of people tend to like to recite mantra and say, oh, mantra can help me to cure illness and so on. Now, during Buddha's time, in a lot of Indian religions, they have mantra. They recite certain mantra to chase away snakes, or they recite some mantra to chase away some evils and things like that. So mantra is basically some sound. May not really make any, the meaning may not have any meaning, but the sound can actually create some effect. Alright, so that is the mantra of the some practitioner during Buddha's time. Now, initially in Buddhism, there's no mantra. But when the Buddha and Bodhisattva, because when they practice, they will also make vows. So they will make vows, and they want to help and guide all sentient beings. So say for example, the Guan Yin Bodhisattva will make vows that anyone who call my name, I will try my best to help. So they also state some saying that say, if you recite this sincerely, then I will come to help. So because this is a vow of the Buddha or Bodhisattva.